Welcome to the podcast series, Ascendem, brought to you by Heidelberg University's Graduate School for Humanities and Social Sciences. Tune in for thought-provoking interviews with experts in different fields, from the social sciences to the humanities, from law to economics. Hello and welcome, HGS podcast series, Ascendem. Today, we have a really distinct guest in our studio, Dr. Johannes Gerwin from Institute for German as a Foreign Language, University of Heidelberg. Welcome, Professor.
Yeah, thank you for having me here.
Today, we are going to talk about a really exciting topic, which is thinking for speaking to yourself. I can say that it's composed of three different branches of linguistics, and maybe Professor can help me to increase the number. The first one is language and thought, the second one is inner speech, and the third one is linguistic relativity theory. But we would like to add any other texts for our listeners.
Well, I think we have to touch upon language production a little bit in the beginning, just to give it all a frame, basically.
Thank you. So let me start with asking traditionally about your academic background briefly, and also how did your academic journey affect your choice of topic, actually, because you also presented this topic at our discussion group in the HGKS. So I'd like to ask you first, could you briefly explain your background a bit, and also what was your motivation to come up with this topic?
Yes. So I studied linguistics, so sociology and history in Berlin, with linguistics as my major. But I had a great professor back then who allowed me to just use his lab and try out whatever equipment was there. So I started becoming interested in psycholinguistics. It was so much fun for me that I decided to go on to do my PhD. I received a stipend from Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics. And I came to Heidelberg because my professor moved. And since then, like for my PhD, basically, I took an interest in a very specific phenomenon in language production. But at the same time, I got in contact with the Heidelberg Research Group, which I will probably make reference to in the next couple of minutes, multiple times. And this research group is actually known, world known, like a renowned research group in the topic of language and thought and linguistic relativity. So I started working with them, you know, first helping them out with, helping the statistical analysis and this kind of stuff. And then after finishing my PhD, I got more heavily involved in what was back then their research topics. And I was convinced to some extent, because when I started working here in Heidelberg, I really believed in the universalist position. We will talk about this later on. And the universalist position basically says that all humans have a universal cognition, universal knowledge, and a language is basically something like an add-on. So there's cognition, which in some terminology, maybe your smartphone, and language is just an app that is installed on the device. So that was to some extent my thinking back then. But being involved in the research of the Heidelberg group, I started seeing things that I didn't expect originally. And now, well, that's almost 10 years ago. So I was involved in many projects by this research group, and we found really interesting effects related to the question how language or languages shape or affect or influence to some extent nonverbal aspects of cognition. And there is one really important, more like a methodological problem, which is related to inner speech. So based on my experiences in the research group, I started becoming interested in inner speech phenomena. And that's, I think that's a long but almost complete story of how I got here basically today.
Actually, I'm really glad that you also mentioned about this difference between the universalistic position and also the linguistic relativity theory, which will be our connecting point to our theme Ascendem, but that will come later on. But first of all, maybe for our listeners who are not really familiar with the basics of the linguistic theory, we can start with talking about the language production, in which we can find a really basic fundamental categorization of the different layers, different aspects of the language production. Mm-hmm. I will just briefly sum it up. The first layer is the conceptualization, and the second one is syntactic encoding and lexical access. The third one is the phonological encoding. Fourth one is the phonetic encoding, and fifth one is the articulation. And there is also a sixth layer, which cannot really be put under this distinction, but we can also take it as one who is monitoring the other ones, the self-monitoring layer. So you also talked about inner speech and also linguistic relativity theory, language and thought. So what were the main layers, main areas that you concentrated on in your research?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good summary of the most important components of the language production system. Maybe in order to make it a little bit easier in what's coming up, it's really important to keep in mind that language involves at least two different layers. So language always has a meaning component and it has a formal component. And the form component refers to everything that makes language audible or readable. Maybe let me give you an overview of the process in relation to the terms that you used already. So it's pretty much acknowledged and agreed upon in the language production literature that everything starts with conceptual preparation. In this, speakers decide on what they want to say, why they want to say it, and how they're going to say it, and also how they relate it to what has been said before and what will be said later on. And what's really interesting is the outcome of this conceptual planning stage is what is called a pre-verbal message. It's pre-verbal. That's really important. And that refers to the idea that at this level of processing, language does not have a form component yet. It is pre-verbal. It happens before access to linguistic knowledge takes place. So once this pre-verbal message is planned, as you mentioned already, the syntax of a sentence has to be built up by making use of what is known as lemmas. These are syntactic features of individual words. And only after that stage, just giving a broad view here, the phonological information is retrieved from what we call the mental lexicon, which is then processed again and put into pronounceable units, basically, and this triggers articulation. Now, what's fascinating is speakers are always their own listeners. Speakers will notice when they make an error, not always, but in many occasions, speakers will note they made a speech error, and they can correct themselves. One aspect of this phenomenon really relates to inner speech, because self-monitoring is able to detect errors before they are articulated. So sometimes you notice that speakers halt their production process while they're making an error, so mid-word, so to say. And how can we explain that someone halts the production process before actually making the error or while making the error? And this points to a mechanism that is pre-articulatory, so before articulation starts. And we think about this as a level of representation that our language comprehension system has access to. So self-monitoring is basically achieved by making use of the language comprehension system, which monitors the speaker's speech after and before it's being articulated.
You have mentioned the importance of self-monitoring system, and we can also talk about the executive control, in other words, maybe attention, which resembles the self-monitoring system, but not the same mechanism, actually. And there is this paradigm in which we can find the standard model, which says that executive control plays a role only on the conceptualization and self-monitoring levels. And do you challenge, actually, this basic concept in your research?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. And when I said this in my presentation, I was referring to the earliest complete models of language production. And indeed, back then, people thought it might be enough, at least for now, I mean, back then, to just consider that attention, and to some extent, this is equated with consciousness, targets the conceptual level, so the planning, the conceptual planning stage, and also the self-monitoring stage. But all the processing steps in between are not accessible by attention. But then later research actually showed that if we sort of have a more differentiated concept of attention, then we can find attention at all levels of processing. So it kind of depends on a lot of other theoretical decisions one has to make. Me personally, I think that attention must be involved in all of the processing steps. And there's also some evidence for it, because if you produce language under certain conditions where you're lacking the relevant degree of attention, then the probability of making errors increases. And it's not just a specific type of error that increases, but all types of errors. So phonological errors increase when you're tired, for example, or when you're engaged in a second task, like driving your car or something like that. But also other types of errors, like you might have problems finding words, you might not get your message straight. So I think that there's quite a bit of evidence also in the research that shows that attention is relevant at all levels. But maybe one more thing I'd like to add. So it has been shown that the probability of detecting a speech error increases towards the end of a phrase. So in language, we produce words which are combined into phrases. And it has been shown that towards the end of a phrase, it's more likely to detect an error that might have occurred as compared to the beginning of a phrase. And this actually highlights to, or this actually points to the idea that there are fluctuations of resources required to encode an utterance. And towards the end of an utterance, or towards the end of a part of an utterance, there are more resources available, which then in turn makes it possible to detect more errors.
Actually, I don't know whether it would be a good idea to recommend right now our listeners to detect our self-corrections while we are speaking until the end of this podcast recording. But please don't lose your attention right now to the topics, to the content of the topics.
Yeah, maybe put it in the comments.
Yeah, sure. And another paradigm maybe in the framework of encoding process, and we can also conceptualize it. First one, the conceptual preparation and the synthetic encoding, and then comes form encoding, and finally we have articulation. So is your research also trying to make a difference in our understanding of the encoding process, and especially the question of whether it works incrementally?
Absolutely. That's a great point. And actually, I'm involved in a current research project that asks specifically about that question. So for our listeners, let me just explain what is meant by incrementality. So holistically would mean that all planning and all preparation would happen in one go, basically. So if you would produce a short idea, maybe, then this idea would be planned ahead at all levels that we talked about. But this would lead to a problem, because this would mean that once you want to express something more complex, which would require a longer sentence, this would lead to longer pauses. So the longer the sentence, the longer the pause before the sentence. But this is obviously not how it works, right? So the two of us, we're producing very complex sentences, and there's hardly any, notable differences in pauses depending on sentence length. So the way it is conceptualized in psycholinguistics is that the complex utterance is partitioned in smaller pieces, and these smaller pieces are called increments. And when we talk about incremental language encoding, we mean encoding piece by piece. And this has a very interesting consequence, because we've just introduced a hierarchical model with the conceptual planning phase, the formulation and articulation phase. And there's one moment in time when each of the three layers is busy working on the current utterance, but each level is busy working on a different piece of the utterance, right? So everything starts with a small increment at the conceptual level, which is passed on to the formulation level. And while formulation is, you know, working out the details, retrieving the sounds and preparing the syllables, the conceptual level is working on the next increment. And then if we move on to like a third increment, then we have the situation where articulation is busy articulating the first increment, while formulation is busy working on the second increment, while conceptual preparation is working on the third increment. So the language production system works in parallel, but also sequentially to some extent. And now, once this is established, yes, I work on incremental language processing and actually also in a cross-linguistic setting. So I'm working on a current project where we expose speakers of 5 different languages to the same stimuli and the same encoding situations. And what I mean by that is we want speakers to describe pictures, but in order to induce an incremental encoding situation, we present the picture not as one holistically, but we present certain aspects of that pictures first, and then the full scene happens. For example, if there's a picture of a woman chasing a chicken or something, that's actually a stimulus in our set, then in one experimental condition, we show the woman first, and then we add the chicken, basically. And then the other condition, we show the chicken first and then add the woman. And our hypothesis is that this type of presentation manipulation would make it more likely to either produce a sentence that starts with the doer, the agent of that scene, the woman chasing the chicken, or in the other condition, we predict that the chicken will end up in the first sentence position, thereby forming a passive sentence. Now, since we compare this between the 5 languages, we find different degrees of sensitivity to this experimental manipulation. So just so you get an impression of what the results look like. So English speakers in this experiment were the most sensitive to this manipulation. So when the chicken was shown first, they are much more likely to produce a passive sentence, like the chicken is being chased by the woman. Whereas on the other end of the spectrum is the speakers of Russian, who hardly ever produce a sentence that starts with a patient. So, for example, a passive sentence. And the other languages we included is Turkish, Mandarin Chinese, German, actually.
The right? Most obvious one.
The most obvious one. And it's really interesting because the results show different results for all 5 languages. So it seems that the way we explain it, if you allow me to say this real quick, the way we explain it is that the linguistic structures that each language offers its speakers leads to different encoding preferences. So in some languages, speakers prefer to work with small increments because their language allows them to produce an utterance without running into errors like all the time. Whereas other languages like Russian or German, you know, makes their speakers wait longer before they start the encoding. This could, for example, be due to things like case marking. You know, everyone who learns German as a second or third language knows about this. It's very difficult to get the cases right, nominative, accusative, and, you know, how all of this information related to nouns relates to or agrees to verbs and this kind of stuff. So the grammar of a language seems to have an impact on how linguistic encoding actually works.
Actually, that's a great point to move on to the discussion, to the framework of the language and thought of it, and maybe linguistic relativity theory in the light of what you explained and in the light of your experiments today. Because when we are learning about the linguistic relativity theory, it has a really long history. Actually, we are not going into the specifics of this history, but what I can say is that there are paradigmatical changes, especially in the linguistic theory, in terms of the importance of the linguistic relativism theory. So that we also see that it starts with the ideas of Wilhelm von Humboldt, and then it gets concretized and also get popularity with the formulation of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, But then its experiences, I would call it as a winter time, in which universalistic approach gains a really important place. Then when we look at today, it also have at summertime, the linguistic relativity theory gained more importance today. And you are using in your slides, in your presentations, this categorization when you are talking about actually the linguistic relativism theory. First one is the simplistic deterministic perspective. The second one is the statistic relativist perspective. And the third one is the dynamic relativist perspective. Where would you like to put your experiences, put your opinions or research experiments in terms of this distinction between different types of linguistic relativism theory today?
When you read about it in the paper or you see it on TV or so, people often talk about the relation between language and thinking or language and thought. And I think it's really important to define what you mean by thinking and what you mean by thought. And this is also important to talk about these three different perspectives on the matter. And if we go back briefly, at least to 18th and 19th century explorers who, you know, got onto ships and explored the world and came into contact with different, well, people who spoke different languages. They, like Wilhelm von Humboldt, for example, I think that they understood something different under the term thinking, which is, I think, more related to what in our everyday life we understand by the term thinking, whereas more modern scientists use the term thinking, but they actually mean cognitive processing, which is not necessarily the same. So thinking in the everyday sense of the word means what an experience you have with yourself when you reflect about the past or you plan something about the future or you evaluate aspects of your daily life. So it is something that is experienced by the individual. And then cognitive processing, on the other hand, is sometimes framed as the something that is underlying the subjective or personal experience to some extent. So when we relate the language and thought debate, well, now I can't use another word than thought, but when we talk about language and cognition, maybe, then it's really important to differentiate what we talk about. And maybe to pick up the terms that you used, so the simplistic view would just say that the language we speak makes our worldview. So if we don't have a word for something, then we don't perceive it, we don't think about it, it's irrelevant to us. So it's really what the language and the words and the structures in the language, what they provide us with is what we perceive of the world. This is obviously wrong. I mean, this, you know, this is just too strong of a formulation of this. This can't be right. So the static relativist position would say that language does have an impact on how our cognitive system works and how it is used while perceiving the world, but it is not absolute in a sense. So it just means that similar to an equalizer on your hi-fi, you know, on your stereo at home, language sort of increases some frequencies, speaking metaphorically, increases or decreases some frequencies. So maybe like one formulation would be that if there's a word in your language for a certain thing, then this would increase the probability of paying attention to that thing in the outside world. A common example is the differentiation between dark and light blue in Russian, like something that was studied 100 times already. So relativist in the sense that all humans can perceive the same things, but the language they use induces some type of preferences, basically. Dynamic means that the language you speak has an effect, and a relativistic effect on cognition, but only when language is being used. So we will talk about this later. Let me give a preview. Mm-hmm. We will talk about later about the thinking for speaking hypothesis. And this is a great example for the dynamic relativist position.
Actually, that was my next question. So we can also proceed with that. And when we are talking about actually language and thought debate, the first thing that comes to the general public's mind is, I guess, thinking for speaking. But you also ask this, maybe I would also call it a provocative question in your presentation. Does language affect thinking beyond thinking for speaking? Mm-hmm. So what would be your ideas and what are your key findings about this question?
Thanks. So I'm not really sure. So I'm not really sure. And this is especially due to my change of perspective in the last couple of years, because you can think about cognition in a like modular sense where there are different components, different modules that have different tasks, basically. But there's a paradigm shift going on. A lot of people reconceptualize their own work in terms of the predictive coding framework. And the idea here is the modules are not that important, but the idea is that humans try to make sense of their environment by generating predictions based on their previous experiences. So whenever you walk into a room and you encounter light and surfaces and so on, then you will predict what this environment is actually made of. What does it mean? What is the source for the signals your eyes perceive, basically? And if you follow this type of approach, then it doesn't make sense to talk about something underlying something, because there's always cognition and cognitive processing anticipating what comes through your senses into your cognitive system. So everything is to some extent flipped upside down. And that's why I struggle a little bit with these old formulations of the question. So is there anything beyond thinking for speaking, or is there anything underlying linguistic cognition? So I don't know. I'm not so sure. And to be honest, I'm not fully able to explain all of this in a non-ambiguous and well thought through way. As of now,
I think it's already clear. Thank you, actually. And another concept that plays a great role in this language and thought debate is the language acquisition, actually, because when we are talking about language and thought debate, it's normal that we consider our mother tongue as the decisive factor which affects our thinking, at least in the conceptualization of the language and thought connection. So what lessons can we take from the research of language acquisition in terms of language and thought debate, actually? I know that there are various experiments on children or on the language acquisition or the second language acquisition, but in the framework of your research and what we have talked about, what is the role of language acquisition?
Yeah, so this gives me a great opportunity to talk a little bit more about thinking for speaking first, because language acquisition plays a major role in explaining this concept. So thinking for speaking means that when you prepare your speech, so you're about to say something, then some pre-linguistic cognitive processing goes on that relates to information selection and information organization. And thinking for speaking, made prominent by Dan Slobin, says that this type of cognition, so the cognition necessary before we actually engage in speaking, this information selection organization, this is already determined or influenced by the language we are going to use, right? So since we are gather experience as humans, we will form pre-verbal messages that are actually easy to encode in our language. So we do not come up with information that is difficult to put into words and map onto language. So in that sense, our language already exerts an effect on pre-verbal processing, right? Now, the question is, how does this happen? Like, how does this come about? And here, language acquisition plays a great role, because when children acquire a language, they don't do this in isolation. They actually do it, and it's a requirement. They do it in a social interaction, in a social setting. And when caregivers talk to kids, they form a relation in which joint attention is really, really important. So if a kid learns a word, for example, it will establish a link between the sound form that the caregiver produces, so the word from our perspective, and the object that the child thinks the caregiver points to. So it establishes a link between the phonological level of a word and the concept that is associated with it. Now, this is true for the acquisition of individual words, but if we look at larger structures where we see actually differences between the languages of the world, then the child will be exposed to these very specific structures in that language, whereas a child learning another language will be exposed to other specific structures specific to that other language. So thinking for speaking only comes about through language acquisition. But there are two more points I'd like to make regarding this. So first of all, it's really interesting to look not only into L1, first language acquisition, but also into L2, meaning second or foreign language acquisition, because there's a lot of research actually by the Heidelberg Group that looks into learners of German who have different native languages. And what you find in all of these studies is that if you present speakers or learners of German with different languages with the same video clips, for example, and ask them to describe them, then they will differ depending on their native language. So in second language acquisition, you can see some traces. You can see entrenchment of the first language. So in that sense, sort of the native language and the experience with it will come to the forefront when speaking in a second language. And the other point I want to make is that also brand new research coming from our lab shows that the language a kid acquires may shape the developmental trajectory. So a PhD student of mine just finished her work looking into how German kids and Chinese kids acquire what we call relative clauses. So the pen that is on the table and the cup that John is holding. So structures like these. And she found it's very convincing evidence that Chinese kids are able to use these structures, produce them about 1 year earlier compared to German kids. So there is evidence that the structures of a language may even impact how well the language will be acquired and in which trajectory. So there's always this twofold interaction between cognition and language. So on the one hand, the content level to some extent, that's what we've been talking about mostly so far, but it also relates to other cognitive phenomena like attention allocation or, as I just said, developmental aspects.
Well, actually, in the framework of experiments that you conducted, one thing plays a key role, actually, the differentiation between verbal and nonverbal texts. Because when we are trying to find out the effects of language on the cognition, we have to also differentiate between how does that differ between the verbal and nonverbal text. So would you like to elaborate on how did you use this distinction between these two different types of cognition in your experiments? Maybe following up on that, you can also elaborate on does that make any difference between simple tasks and complex tasks in terms of how we use language, or do we still need language when we are coming up with the simplest tasks?
Yeah, those are excellent points, really. And this goes into the heart of the debate, actually. So it is one thing to compare groups of speakers, like each group speaking a different language, and then finding that they talk about different things in the same videos. Okay, that's one thing. Great. So they select different types of information and they organize the information maybe differently. But then the question is, does this or a similar effect would also arise in as a scenario where these two groups of speakers do not have to speak, but in which their task is what some people call nonverbal, so making some decisions by, you know, pressing a button or making some categorizations like you see a picture, picture A, you memorize it, it goes away. Then you see picture B and picture C, and your task is to say which picture B or C is more similar to picture A. That would be like a categorization task. And this would be considered a nonverbal task by many because the response is nonverbal. You press a button or you move your mouse or whatever it is. But there's obviously a problem with that, and that is related to inner speech. So a lot of people have conducted research like that and have faced the criticism that these types of tasks cannot rule out that participants actually did use language, but covertly, not by saying things aloud, but by using language only in their head. And this has sparked a lot of controversy in the field, because if that is true, and I believe it is true to some extent, then how do you deal with that situation? So do you come up with an idea that allows you to suppress the use of inner speech? And is that even possible? So far, the available research shows that differences between languages can be observed in verbal tasks, in nonverbal tasks, where people assume inner speech was used, but also in tasks in which it can be excluded that people used inner speech. But there are findings for and against theories. But you ask, or let me go on. You also ask about simple and complex tasks, and that's really important. And we're now going into the territory of inner speech with this. So again, it depends on what you define as simple and what is complex to some extent. So a complex task for me would be something like planning your day. Like, what are you going to do today? First, you, I don't know, go to the library, then you're going to have dinner or lunch probably first, and so on. So a very complex task that involves multiple steps, multiple cognitive operations, whereas maybe a simple task could be something like a categorization task. But then on the other hand, categorization is not that simple. So if you think about what it entails, what does it entail to recognize similarities and differences? It's not that simple, you know, through that lens. But the research on inner speech shows that complex cognitive tasks lead to a certain performance. You know, for example, the Tower of London task, I can explain later what that means. Mm-hmm. In tasks like that, it can be shown that if you prevent speakers or participants, experiment participants, from using inner speech, their performance goes down. So in certain tasks that require planning and decision making, people perform better if they're allowed to use inner speech, whereas their performance will go down if they have to do a secondary task that supposedly, I'm very skeptical about this, but that supposedly suppresses the use of inner speech.
Building on that, I'd like to ask really short and striking question in order to show the importance of the inner speech, actually. Language precognition, is it even possible?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I struggle with that a little bit. One reason is because of the predictive coding framework I mentioned earlier. And then probably there is language precognition, but can we study it? I think that's the key issue. So if you're a musician, for example, and you start jamming on your piano or your guitar or something, then something is going on. There is music cognition going on, and this typically does not involve language, at least not language that you can perceive through your inner ear. So I'd say that there are tasks, a lot of things going on that are language-free. But the question is, how far can we get with language-free cognition?
Well, actually, you also mentioned about the methodological challenges with these experiments, and we are talking about actually inner speech. I think that's one of the most difficult areas to find really reliable results, because you have to, at some point, ask the participants about their inner speech and how they experience it. So that also creates a liability problem, I guess, because you have to use these introspective methods in order to understand. And also you are using introspective methods in terms of examining your inner speech to generalize your findings. So what were your recommendations for these kind of problems, which have existed actually throughout the linguistic experiments, but maybe you could give recommendations in order to restrict the effects of these challenges?
Yeah, that's really a good point. So inner speech is something you cannot observe with, you know, your ears. Obviously, it's inner. It's not perceivable auditorially. But if we have access to brain imaging techniques, for example, then we can see inner speech in a scanner. There are known areas in the brain that will light up if people think verbally, if they produce inner speech. Then what's also interesting is you can measure muscle activity and certain potentials near the articulatory organs, where you will find activity that would also be present if you would articulate your language, like overtly. So there are some potentials that you can measure. But this relates to inner speech that is already really far down the line. So it's really inner speech that is very close to articulation. But there are other ways of inner speech, like more compressed ones, more abstract types of inner speech. But you're absolutely right. It is a methodological issue. And although I'm really happy about all the neuroscientific methods we have today, there's still a large step to take. You know, seeing something and knowing it is going on versus knowing what is going on in more concrete terms. So I have started doing surveys where I ask people about their personal experiences with inner speech. And I didn't believe in it at first. It was just like a pilot project. But then now that more than 80 people participated in this survey, it turned out to be very, very rich in terms of what you can learn about inner speech. So in this survey, I asked people about situations in which they would use inner speech. Well, I didn't say use, but experience inner speech, because I don't want to put this intentional aspect to it. I want to ask if they perceive inner speech in situation X, Y, or Z. And people were also able to give like their own responses. So it was a mixed methods approach. They could also type in some of their answers. And in the second part of the survey, I asked about the features of inner speech. So sort of what it sounds like. And I asked people, for example, do you experience inner speech in different languages? So in your first language and in your second language. And so I think that this method of asking people in a structured way is not a bad approach at all. So specifically, if we can get large amounts of people and standardized questionnaires. Yeah. And I think it's really important to look further into this specifically, or especially since they are people who do not seem to experience inner speech. So people who have aphantasia, so people who do not necessarily generate mental images, like visual images, and a subpopulation of those people also do not experience inner speech whatsoever. So I think it's really important to work more on this beyond just looking at brain activity, but also to like more from a phenomenological side, and then also correlate this phenomenological data with experimental data where you measure, I don't know, reaction times, eye movements, fixation durations, this type of stuff. So really like a broader approach to the topic. That would be my suggestion.
I'd like to ask second and final methodological challenge that normally the researchers who are working in this field of linguistic relativism theory face with, which is the generalizability problem of the research. Because in a research, in an experiment, you can only measure the effects of just one task normally, which also raises the question, okay, that's fine. Okay, that affects this task, but can we generalize this for the other tasks? We also talked about this problem of the definitions of simple and complex tasks. So in terms of this generalizability problem, is there a way out actually, or it is still something that will exist in terms of raising these questions against the supporters of the linguistic relativism theory?
Yeah, that's a very important point. And it applies to all empirical research, basically, at least in psychology or some parts of cognitive science. And I think it is a serious issue. One layer to this question is that like a while back, a few years back, you couldn't really publish papers that did not find an effect, right? So this makes me wonder how many people have tried to find, for example, these linguistic relativity effects, or effects that are related to the question of, you know, the relation between language and thought, that are not published. You know, people had done the research, but it's not published. The lack of an effect is unknown, or like how often you do not find an effect. So that's one issue. And then, so I totally agree with all you said. You can only measure one task in one experiment. You can only measure a certain selection of participants. Mostly it's college students. That's true for all over the world. Like most psychological studies use psychology students, you know, because they have to participate in experiments in order to receive course credit. You know, it's like the most convenient way to get your subjects. I mean, it's not the case for all studies, but there are a lot of studies that are like that. And then also it relates to the stimulus selection that you made. So in principle, there's an indefinite number of stimuli that you could use in your experiment, but then you have to make a selection. And then some other factors determine your selection. So is the visual saliency of something in a photograph that you want to use distributed evenly? So maybe, so imagine you found a great picture that would be perfect for studying some aspect of linguistic relativity. But then you notice, well, in this picture, there is a person with a red sweatshirt or something. Then you cannot really use it because it would attract attention of participants. So there is also a lot going on in the selection process of the stimuli. Anyway, so it's bottomless, basically. But in the last couple of years, people had started to obey best practices. And that is pre-registration. So you use OSF, Open Science Forum, for example, and you describe your study real quick and you describe your hypothesis, typically in the sense of if hypothesis A, then results would look like this. If hypothesis B, then results would look like that, for example. So, and you can argue, if you like, you can also argue for either one of the hypotheses, but it's really important to be open. To be open about the background, the theory that you use, and how your theory relates to the experiments that you want to present, conduct, and then analyze the data. And also, like a second really important thing is the idea that people have started maybe 5 years ago to publish their data and their statistical methods. Some, like many journals, require their authors to do this. So you have to be really open, present your data, publish the data, and describe exactly how you arrive at your conclusions. And I think this is really, really important and must be underlined. It's important to realize that certain findings actually depend on the statistical method that was used. Right. And that is really important to be open. And this is, I think, the only way in which it is possible or maybe possible to tackle this question of generalizability and replication.
I would like to end our formal part, actually, with asking two, a certain extent, philosophical questions, which can also align what we have talked about with our overarching theme, us and them. The first one is actually coming from Socrates, because Socrates, as far as I know, was the first philosopher who talked about this inner speech and the functions of the inner speech. We are not going to explain all the details, but in our traditional understanding, if we are talking with somebody, that needs two different entities who are communicating with each other. So if we consider that, okay, we have an inner speech, the question is then who we are talking to. Is it something that also linguistic theory is pursuing to answer, or is it something totally out of this right now at this paradigmatically linguistic theory in today's world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I think, definitely beyond the scope of psycholinguistics. It is within the realm of cognitive science, I'd say, but there in the field that I am in, there's not much you can find, except for one model that is not very specific, but it gives you an outline, like a preliminary understanding of what might be going on in relation to your question when people produce inner speech. And this model is actually related to something we call audience design in psycholinguistics. And that's the idea that speakers attune their utterances to their hearers, right? So if you talk to a kid, then you would use different words and a different syntax specifically for that kid. You know, you wouldn't talk to a kid like you would talk to an adult, for example. That's one example of audience design. Or you scream when the environment is loud, right? You talk louder. So audience design means adapt to the knowledge and to the listener. And this model that I'm thinking of right now tries to explain this audience design in a mechanistic way. And this model introduces, in addition to the regular discrete serial language production system, another component to it that is known in other branches of research as forward modeling. And in this forward modeling, you would generate a representation that you can use to simulate, you know, simulate what it would be like to say X or Y. And then there's, and this is the like close to the answer of your question, I think. And then there is an evaluator. So this extra thing, this forward model relies on a production component, a generative component, but it's also important is the evaluation component. So this thing that evaluates it, and both are the same individual. Right. So if we want to use this model to explain inner speech, then both the addressee and the speaker are the same.
I really like the idea to actually find out who we are talking to and at least have an answer for this dichotomy within an individual itself so that we can also understand the properties of the other self who we are talking to actually.
Yeah, but let me add
sure,
one thing
please.
Real quick. This forward modeling is a type of simulation, right? So you simulate something in order to predict what, if there were an audience, how they would react. So the way you evaluate your simulated communicative contribution basically is sort of linked to your experience that you have with your language community, for example. So there is influence of people that could be there in general. So maybe I need to revise what I said. So the evaluation process happens within the same cognitive system. The same cognitive system produces and receives and evaluates. But then the knowledge that is used in that process is shaped by social experiences. So maybe there is a them in us.
Maybe there's an us, but there's no them.
Right.
But we don't know. My second question is about this immanent property of the linguistic relativist theory, actually, which supposes that the language that we possess actually also affects our thinking. And one can also conclude that the differences between different language speakers also stems from that fact, and which can also be considered as a contributing factor for the ascendant dichotomy. But maybe more dramatically, we can also consider that fact that, okay, two different language speakers cannot really communicate actually 100%, which can give them an opportunity to understand each other's thoughts. So there are a lot of different variations of the linguistic relativity theory, sure, but what would be your recommendation considering that, okay, there's some kind of a barrier between two different language speakers? Mm-hmm. What would be your recommendation to overcome these problems, to overcome this ascendant dichotomy?
Well, I'm not sure if I have any idea on how to overcome this dichotomy, but I still have something to say about it. So in this type of research, empirical research in general, it is about finding biases and tendencies, meaning that if you look at 100 people who speak language A and you look at 100 people who speak language B, then you will try to find a bias, like not a categorical difference, but a bias that only comes out of the data when you average the data. Right. And this means that in both populations, speakers of language A and language B, there are probably a lot of pairs. So people who do not differ that much or only minimally. Right. So there are people who are interested in playing the guitar and, I don't know, hanging out at the Neckarwiese or something in both groups, basically. And then there are architects in both groups who are interested in architecture and this kind of stuff. So this linguistic relativity is about biases. It is not about the direct comparison between individuals. It is about the comparison between groups. So I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Totally, actually. The denying the existence of the general definition of this problem is also a way to solve it, because maybe we are understanding the problem wrong. Mm-hmm. And if we also concentrate on the biases part, that could be a solution, actually.
Yeah.
So that we can also align ourselves when communicating with the others.
Absolutely. And maybe one more thing to add. So everyone knows that in most languages, there are occurrences of new words which are imported from another language. So, I don't know, Wanderlust, Schadenfreude, these types of words. I mean, I hate these examples, but they're good examples in this context. So these are words that have been imported into English, right? And they cover something that an English word would not cover. So they make it possible to refer, like for an English speaker to refer to a certain experience that this speaker has. This person can share it with other people, right? So what that implies to me is that if there is a word to describe something, maybe like these examples, or maybe if you have words to describe certain emotions or something like this, then it makes it easier to recognize this experience later on. So I believe that us and them, we all are able to have the same experiences, and we do experience the world in very similar ways. But since we speak different languages, we have different means to recognize it. So I know it when I see it, basically. I know it when I have a word for it, and to memorize it, basically. So it is more about the identifiability of an experience and the possibility to memorize this. So words in different languages offer us tools to recognize and to remember certain things. But this really does not exclude the possibility that us and them, we all do have and can share the same experiences. And if there is enough pressure, in quote unquote, to have a word for a certain experience, then it will be imported, and speakers of a language community will invent a word to do that. Yeah, so in general, language is very dynamic. There are new words all the time, every day. There are new words. And I think that it's important to maybe overcome if there is indeed such a barrier between us and them.
Well, Dr. Gavin, I'm amazed by the quantity of information that we get throughout this interview, and I'd like to thank you for this wonderful interview. Traditionally, we also ask our guests one more personal question, but in your case, we cannot really consider it as informal one. It's also one of your academic activities, but I would also consider it as an engagement project, because it's a wonderful idea to give a background information to our listeners. Dr. Gavin is also coordinator of the CAS Cognitive Science Program, which is open to master and PhD students from different disciplines. Mm-hmm. So what was your motivation, actually, when you also came up with the idea that cognitive science could also be really useful for the other disciplines, for the students of the other disciplines? Maybe useful is a wrong word, because we are not learning something always for the sake of using it. But in your case, maybe would you like to elaborate on the benefits of learning cognitive science, and how does that program work?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so grateful that you bring this up. So there is a certificate of advanced studies, cognitive science, and whoever is interested will find this under this name, the CAS, Cognitive Science, Heidelberg. You'll find the information on the internet. And this is a program that is free of charge and is offered to anyone who's interested at the master's and PhD level, as you already said. The goal is to foster interdisciplinary research. So it is really a research-focused certificate that people can obtain, and that allows people to look into new disciplines that they, in their major or during doing their dissertation, do not have the chance to look into. So within this certificate program, students have the possibility to take several courses from totally different disciplines, and we try to make people connect their own research interest with a new discipline from the cognitive sciences. And so far, we had already very interesting collaborations. So we have people who are more on the biology side, so neuroscience people who look at the neurons, you know, this level, and then they take courses in philosophy, for example. So really from the very small elements to the great questions of humanity, so to say. Then we also have people who are from computer science, so who have the hard skills of, you know, programming and doing all kinds of training and, you know, modeling stuff and so on. And I vividly remember, because we had a little conference the other day, there was one student who used his abilities in computer science and applied it to a topic in psychiatry, you know, in order to sort of, a very idealistic idea, but he thought and he proposed that it might be possible to improve the way that mental health is viewed and diagnosed and so on. So the certificate, the program offers the possibility to widen or expand your horizon. And I personally enjoy this very much, because the students I have met so far,
including me,
including you, you know, they also expand my horizon like a lot. So I'm very thankful for, you know, me personally having this opportunity to be involved and engaged in this program. Certificate of Advanced Studies Cognitive Science.
We are really grateful that you came up with this idea, opening up this program to the whole disciplines. And as a student of this program, I would like to emphasize that it's really important to leave your comfort zone. And also, it's a great way to engage with the cognitive science. And I think it's kind of a topic that you can relate with any discipline that you are actually concentrating on. That would be the, I think, correct interpretation of the importance of the cognitive science.
Yeah, exactly. And the linking between the smallest levels, basically, with the you know, highest levels. I remember that we also talked about this previously, about cognitive architecture. So what is going on in one's own or someone else's individual cognitive system and relating this to society. Right now, I can say this for sure, we are lacking enough people who are interested in the societal level. So people from sociology and politics and so on.
Thank you so much, Dr. Garvin, for this wonderful interview and also your remarks about the program, CAS Cognitive Science Program. So we are concluding our podcast for now. And if you liked our episode, please also check our previous episodes and also stay tuned for the upcoming episodes. We'd like to see you again in the next weeks. Bye.
Yeah, thank you again and bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the HGGS podcast series, Asandem. In this series, we bring you conversations with experts from a wide range of disciplines, from the social sciences to the humanities, from law to economics. If you enjoyed our podcast, we invite you to explore our previous episodes and subscribe to our channel so you never miss a new episode. Stay tuned for more insightful interviews coming soon.